This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena to better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat can't make it today. We are joined, however, by Peter Slezak. You are an advocate for, I guess, Palestinian justice.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. Good way of putting it.
Yeah, so because I know you're affiliated with a lot of different groups, but that seems to be your identity these days. I mean, you're going around lecturing circuits, talking about, in particular, the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement.
It's directed at any organization, not necessarily Israeli, and most of the leading targets were not Israeli targets. There was a number of organizations mm-hmm. which were profiting from the criminal occupation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so they were targeted for divestment and boycott.
Right. So I imagine it's a wide network of brands and chains that's involved then.
Anything that is arguably profiting from the crimes of the State of Israel mm-hmm. In its occupation, and there are quite a lot. The boycott has different versions. So some people, including many of the Jews around the world, and some of the very prominent Zionists in America, have a version of the boycott which is restricted to the West Bank products and companies and so on. Others feel, with some important justification, that the whole of the State of Israel is mm-hmm. profiting from the, or at least complicit and guilty mm-hmm. For the occupation. And so there's a case to be made for boycotting much more widely. Mm-hmm. So it's a controversial issue, but all of them are concerned, as he said, with justice and human rights and international law, and mm-hmm. hoping that this could exert pressure on governments, because in the end, this is a civil society movement around mm-hmm. the world which is hoping to make important policy changes. And we see some good signs of that.
That's good. And I want to delve into that in detail today, largely to note about the history of the movement and its gains, some of the challenges and criticisms it faces. But I am intrigued by your background, and largely because in Malaysia in particular, I don't think there is enough of a nuanced difference made between Judaism and Zionism. There are no Jews, at least that's what we're told in the country, despite the fact that there being Jews everywhere else in Southeast Asia. So I think you're a bit of an exotic character here during this trip.
That's the nicest thing anybody said to me.
Well, now we have it on air on record for anybody to reference. But I am curious about your grandparents being Holocaust survivors. I mean, that's one of the things.
My grandparents, my parents.
Oh, your parents, right.
Both my mother and father and my grandmother. But I grew up with my mother and father and my grandmother, who were both, all three of them were survivors of the Holocaust directly.
So, I mean, that puts you in a very interesting, some might say complex position. I mean, how did then you become committed to invest, you know, your time and, you know, perhaps even risk your quote-unquote identity?
That's a funny way to put it, Fuad. It's not risking my identity, and it's not a paradox, as you suggest, although you're right that most Jews don't respond as I have done. But look, firstly, I have to say I'm not alone. Some of the most prominent advocates and champions of Palestine are Jews with Holocaust parents, mm-hmm. and I'll mention them because they're very important, and I'm proud to be among them. There's Noam Chomsky. He's not a Holocaust survivor, but he's a student and protege, Norman Finkelstein. Mm-hmm. Sarah Roy at Harvard University is the world's leading expert on Gaza. She's a political economist. Her parents are Holocaust survivors. Amira Haas, who's mm-hmm. a journalist at Haaretz in Israel. She lives in Ramallah, but her mother, was a survivor of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Now, their motivation is like mine. It's kind of instinctive. There's a lesson we're supposed to have learned, which mm-hmm. I just somehow instinctively learned from my parents. And I don't know why other Jews don't see it that way. You know, the slogan is never again. Mm-hmm. And we cite the enormous, I mean, you know, really genocide. Mm-hmm. But the point was not just never again to Jews. It's right. never again to anybody. Yep. Do we have to really say that to people? Now, sadly, it's very awkward for me because I don't like being critical of the Jews, but I have to be. The fact is that, of course, not all Jews, but the Jewish community has a direct responsibility because the State of Israel acts in the name of all Jews. Mm-hmm. You can't pretend otherwise, and you can't look away and be silent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Jews have an expression to describe those non-Jews who stood up and supported them at great risk to their lives during the war. They're called the righteous Gentiles,
mm-hmm.
righteous among the nations. We celebrate these people who, at great cost often to themselves or great risk, stood up and saved and protected Jews, and we honor them.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep asking, where are the righteous Jews today? Well, the few that I mentioned, plus yep. very many others, they're a very small minority. And they get abused by the mm-hmm. mainstream Jewish community. So, yeah, so it's not quite a paradox. It seems like the natural thing. And throughout history, there have always been Jews who have seen the universal aspect of their culture rather than just the narrow tribal nature
right.
of their commitment. Everybody has a tribe they belong to.
I want to probe into that a bit further. Is there a different attitude towards the issue? I mean, being dissident Jews, right, from... say, those who are based in Israel and those who are sort of part of the emigre culture, right? Because one can say that there's a bit of a distance historically and geographically, and maybe that makes it safer for you to speak out as opposed to being a voice directly at the heart of the geography, right?
Look, I don't know about safer. You get a lot of abuse. It's not particularly nice. I have a couple of emails and Facebook posts today that are really revolting. In fact, like I mentioned, the way they do it. Even... the newly appointed ambassador to Israel in America, who's a Jew who is actually on the board of one of the settlements, he called Jews who, I think they're in favor of, I don't know whether it was the, it wasn't the boycott, but it was supporting Palestinian justice. He called them capos. Capos were those Jews in the concentration camps that collaborated with the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing worse you can say to a Jew
mm-hmm.
because we know what that meant. Now, I've just got to post today calling me a capo. I've had it before. This is revolting. And it tells you the depth of feeling. But we're talking about abuse and vilification, which, I mean, it's I don't want to exaggerate mm-hmm. the problem. For me especially, it's not that difficult because I have long ago distanced myself from the Jewish community. But when we came public in Australia as outspoken critics, many who were sympathetic couldn't express it publicly with us. They couldn't mm-hmm. sign our statements because their parents would disown them, their community would expel them. So for some people, it's much more costly. And I have to say, it's not that difficult for me.
Can you share a bit about your personal journey, right? Because coming to this issue and then in many ways dedicating yourself to it, because from what I understand, at least Chomsky and Finkelstein had radical backgrounds, right? So I think Chomsky's grandparents were anarchists, and then, you know, he inherited that worldview, and that allowed him to view and offer a critical lens to look at humanitarian issues more broadly. I mean, what was your background? I mean, were your parents activists? How did you get tuned into this discourse?
Look, it's an interesting question. I've actually written an autobiographical piece, and I won't recite the whole story, but where do I start? Look, part of it is that I was a dropout from Sydney University when I started a science degree, and it's not irrelevant entirely. I studied science, and I loved science, but I studied what I wanted, and it didn't pass my exams. But that meant that my friends who were all Jewish, they went on to great careers in medicine and law and other things. And I ended up at the other university where I am now, studying sociology and philosophy and psychology. And I suddenly found myself among activists. It was during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And they spoke of social justice and human rights. And none of my friends ever thought about this. I never thought about any of this. And it was during the Vietnam War, and we marched against the war to protest against America. And so I became politically more conscious than I was. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it was a kind of inevitable path. I read Chomsky about the Vietnam War,
right.
which was one of the most important exposés of the criminality of that war. And so inevitably you find a path, and he wrote also about Israel. So it's a long story, but by degrees I ended up... and also the other aspect, if I may say, that makes my history different. My parents, you thought perhaps they were in some ways political. My parents were completely apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
We never talked politics at home at all, unlike maybe Chomsky or others. And one of the features of that that's particularly relevant here is I didn't know what the word Zionism meant. I was mm-hmm. asked when I was a kid at school by one of my Jewish friends, and I was embarrassed. I didn't know what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents didn't send me to the Zionist camps, youth camps that all my friends went to. To this day, they've got this solidarity and kind of camaraderie that they developed. And I didn't go to any of that stuff, and I didn't get my head filled with Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it was easy for me to see what I think is clearly the truth about the matter, because I don't have to throw off a lot of baggage, a lot of emotional. And
right.
I know some of my Jewish friends who have now come over here, it's still very difficult for them
right.
emotionally.
Right.
So in a way, I'm an example of somebody for whom it was easy
mm-hmm.
and I understand how hard it is, because I'm arguing with a lot of these people show them against their all their instincts that they're responsible for terrible. Mm-hmm. They can't admit the history. They can't admit what's going on today.
Right, right. Let's talk about the BDS movement now more particularly. Like, can you situate its earliest beginnings, right? Who floated this idea and how did it gain traction in the way it has now?
I think in about 2005, Palestinian civil society, very many, perhaps most of the Palestinian groups, initiated this BDS boycott development divestment sanctions movement. And it's been catching on and it's spreading like wildfire around the world. In all countries, including Malaysia, you have a very strong movement here. In Australia and all around the world, in America, many Jewish groups are supporting it. And in Ireland, it's a strong group. They have their own interesting radical political reasons for it. Mm-hmm. They have a very successful boycott movement. I always cite the Dunn Stores boycotts. And so it's growing. And the important thing about it is, if I can say, it's a movement for ethical investment. Mm-hmm. It's an act of conscience by people who are concerned. But, of course, the obvious thing to say, it's also an act of nonviolent protest. Mm-hmm. It's a peaceful protest. The reason I mention that and emphasize it, because the Israeli lobby and the Jewish communities have the I don't know what the word is. It's almost impossible to describe how offensive it is. They describe the BDS movement by reminding people what happened to the Jews in the 1930s when there was a slogan that the Nazis painted on shops and had in posters. In German, the words are Kauft nicht bei Juden, which means don't buy from Jews. Mm. Now, this was part of the Nazi racist, in fact, genocidal Holocaust in Germany. And for the Jews to compare BDS to that is a disgrace and an unspeakable affront. So I'm, with my credentials, in a position to encourage people not to pay attention and not to allow themselves to be bullied by this. Mm-hmm. And the reason that the Jews do it is because it works. People have learned from the Holocaust that anti-Semitism is an appalling a racist prejudice. Sadly, today we're seeing it now directed to the Muslims, I have to say that, and the Jews ought mm-hmm. to know better, but that's a different conversation.
Right, right.
All I'm saying is that the BDS movement should not be slandered with this disgraceful description, and that shows you how little they have to say by way of answer to it, if mm-hmm. that's what they resort to. Mm-hmm. That tells you, and its strength is precisely that it stands for justice and for decency and international law. The planks of the right. boycott movement has three principles: end the occupation, observe international law, and the right of return for Palestinians. Now, that's problematic in various practical ways, but these are the principles. What's to object to?
Mm-hmm. Now, just for more contextual detail, to what extent was this an alternative in light of the failure of two things? The first, the failure of militancy, right, which for the longest part was the struggle connected to broader discourse in Arab nationalism, so on and so forth, and then also the failure of the peace processes. Right, so did these activists look and say, look, we've tried the militancy route, we've tried the diplomatic route, let's try the consumer route now? Was that part of the discussion?
Or? I'm sure it is. I maybe have to talk to Palestinians who are better able to talk about their mm-hmm. strategies as Palestinians. They haven't abandoned the struggle. The resistance to the occupation, is we're seeing it today with the hunger strike of the prisoners. I'm not quite up to date with that.
Right,
I
right.
see that happening. Inside Palestine, there's the ongoing resistance. By the way, I should say that inside Palestine, armed resistance against a military occupation is legal. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be described as terrorists. And I've had the privilege of meeting some wonderful Palestinians here in Malaysia. And hearing their stories is terrible.
Yeah.
Everyone is touched by some appalling tragedy. And but the most remarkable thing about them is the Arabic word is sumud, their resistance, their steadfastness mm-hmm. is the word. And but, you know, they resort to peaceful means of all sorts. It's a complicated story as far as the Palestinians are concerned. So BDS is only one of the mm-hmm. aspects
one prong
of their
of the
resistance.
Different aspects, right?
There
right.
are others. And, of course, we on the outside world who are not Palestinians are taking up the struggle on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different. I think you asked me before about the difference between the Israelis and the diaspora Jews. That's an important aspect. The Israeli community, the Jewish community, They're all very far on the right. Israel is beyond hope, I think. And that's why some of the Israeli activists are appealing to us on the outside, where the change will only come from us on the outside. So we have a very important responsibility.
Interesting. Let's take a break for now. We'll come back to more details on the movement, that is the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement, of whom we have a representative. We have Peter Slezak joining us this week to share his life, but also his perspective on the changes that are taking place and how we can all participate as well. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This is Night School. You're listening to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Joining us this week is Peter Slezak. You are an activist for the BDSM movement, and that is short for the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement against Israel, or against Zionist complicit products more broadly. And we'll talk about the details of what that means. And that's to end the Palestinian occupation, right? And the first part of the show, you gave a bit about your historical background, your biography and political maturity. And also you described the core tenets of the BDS movement and what it hoped to achieve. Let's talk a bit more specifically now. It seems like the demand is quite gigantic, right? Insofar as a lot of companies are connected somehow to the conflict.
Yeah.
So where does one start to think about, you know, how all that is connected and where the consumer can somehow respond?
Look, each group around the world, in Australia and here in Malaysia, I've been privileged to hear from leaders and activists here in the movement. You have to choose your targets, and that's a decision you make according to what you think is going to be more effective. I have to say that the targets are, of course, intended to be affected by the divestment and the sanctions. But I think that the point of the movement is not necessarily to bring Israel to its knees, because that's not going to happen. I think the most important effect actually is symbolic, that it's a form of education. People are becoming conscious. It raises their consciousness. It points to a moral question, and you were divesting for a reason to highlight the crimes, and that people are profiting from the crimes.
Can you give me an example of a product that would be a good kind of way to start, right, to think about this?
Well, I'll give you examples of products that have withdrawn from the West Bank as a result of it. Veolia, which is some kind of cleaning, and they've got all sorts of... I see them in Sydney with trucks that are picking up the garbage. So they're a very big multinational corporation. I think they've either withdrawn or were seriously affected by that. I'm not up to date on this, but the other one is Caterpillar. Mm-hmm, Caterpillar is the company that you see their logo, their name, on the demolition equipment.
Right.
And, you know, it's relevant, instead of talking in such abstract terms, Israel has demolished nearly 50,000 houses in the West Bank since 1967. These are ordinary people who are living in their own land, and in the middle of the night, the army comes in and tells them, we've declared your area a closed military zone. You've got half an hour to get out. It's an unbelievable tragedy. This is not the worst thing happening in the West Bank, but this is one of the most grotesque crimes against innocent people. And so, yeah, boycotting Caterpillar is a good target. Mm-hmm. And there are other ones like, you know, SodaStream, which was making soda water in the camp. It's complicated because, of course, a lot of the Palestinians work for these companies, and the argument is you're depriving them of work. But like in South Africa, I think many Palestinians are willing to pay that price. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of companies. There's G4S, that's a security company, looks after jails and things, and I think they were involved. And I think these are all pulling out or mm-hmm. being affected.
So as a consumer, right, it seems like a passive move. It seems like all I have to do is not purchase these products. But a lot of the products you mentioned too are not really everyday kind of products.
That's exactly right.
So
that's right.
That's part of a problem, it seems.
There's labeling of dates that come from the West Bank. There's a whole issue about that. And everybody can do their bit. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you have to think of what's appropriate. I mean, apart from just being a thoughtful consumer with integrity, people should join the movement and do something if it's a cause that they feel strongly about. And so there's lots one can do.
Yeah.
And the activists here are terrific. The people that are engaged in this issue in various ways.
Yeah, you mentioned South Africa, and that's very interesting, largely because, of course, Israel and the apartheid regime's friendship for the longest time, and also the close connection between the two liberation movements. But to what extent does BDS draw a lot of lessons from the South African experience?
That's a very good question, and one has to be a bit careful that there are different situations. There are similarities and differences. I think as an academic exercise, it's interesting to make these comparisons. I think it's not necessary. It sometimes gets confusing because there are important similarities, but there are important differences.
Sure.
One thing to say is that you have to talk more specifically about Israel itself, the West Bank and Gaza, because they're very different. I mean, and people who know about South Africa and apartheid, Desmond Tutu and people like this came out, Jewish South African Khazirils, they've come out and they're uncompromising that this is apartheid. There's just a report that's just come out by Richard Falk, which is an extensive report saying that according to the international law, this is literally a case of apartheid. Okay, and there have been cases like that before. But what I wanted to say was that, look, the West Bank is worse than apartheid. They are killing people, unarmed children and civilians. 2,000 children have been killed since the year 2000. These are children, often killed by snipers from a great distance. These are not, and in some cases, I've been to a village like Bil Ayin, where there's a Friday demonstration. They shoot dead unarmed protesters. I had the privilege of walking and marching with them. I mean, what's going on? So, the question of apartheid has to be seen. The word is, in a way, unhelpful because then you get bogged down in making comparisons. Actually, you know, for various other tactical reasons, when I'm talking especially to my Jewish friends, the few that still want to talk to me or people that I can argue with, I avoid the word. Not because it's not literally true, but because it creates a kind of an obstacle to having the conversation. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk about the facts that I've just mentioned to you. Mm-hmm. Look at the water. They're stealing the water. The wall is occupying 10% of Palestine. It's not for defense and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's actually where the realities are.
Well, Jimmy Carter, in one of his explanations for why he used that word, it was, if I'm not mistaken, he said that it was already in popular usage and it's an analogy that one can draw. I mean, I'm not that convinced either, in a sense that I think your perspective is very interesting because then it becomes a question about what apartheid means rather than the uniqueness of the,
that's a semantic question.
Of the conflict. Yeah,
I'm happy to use it. I'm careful about the words I use. But you see, the thing is, I'm very anxious about having the dialogue. I mean, most of the meetings I go to in Sydney and Australia, I know everybody there. Mm-hmm. This is a pity. Here, it's wonderful because I don't know everybody. But also here, many of the people that come to the meetings are also, they're already on side, especially mm-hmm. Malaysia, which is great. We had one member of the audience last night that actually was arguing with me, which is great. But so the point is, if you want to have a dialogue with people, you don't want to put an obstacle in the way of having a conversation. Mm-hmm. And this is like you use these words like apartheid and ethnic cleansing to beat people over the head, to tell them how terrible
you
are.
It's already very loaded, yeah. And
so
people get defensive.
I get that. And ethnic cleansing is also literally appropriate. Ilan Pape, an important historian, has used that word to show that legally, technically, it's appropriate. But you understand.
Communication is a lot about strategy to be effective. Yeah.
If you want to get through to people.
Yeah. Now, the BDS movement has also had its fair share of critics. I have in mind rather high-profile ones too, like Norman Finkelstein,
absolutely,
for example. So what are some of their grievances against BDS and what are your responses to that?
Look, it's a very important question. Norman Finkelstein and Noam Chomsky, I regard them as greatest heroes for the Palestinians and for a lot of other things. But they have been critical. And I'll mention them quickly and what I think the response is. I listen to them very carefully because I respect them and admire them, and I want to be sure that I understand it, so I don't want to just be part of what Finkelstein called the cult.
Right.
He's very rude. He's kind of like, he's insensitive in a way to the social niceties, and he just says what he thinks, and he's an honest guy. But he accused the BDS movement of being a cult, and I always say, ironically, in a way, they confirmed it by rounding on him and attacking him, even calling him a secret Zionist, which is an appalling thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
He's devoted. In fact, he sacrificed his career for exposing the truth about Palestine. His concern, which is very important, is the following. Many of the leading advocates for Palestine, Ali Abu Nimeh, the leader of the BDS movement, Omar Barghouti, they support the one-state solution to the problem. They say that two states is finished, and there's a case there. But Finkelstein is angry because people use the BDS movement as a fig leaf to cover their one-state push. Now, Finkelstein's point, and I state it sympathetically because he's right, he says, look, you can't have it both ways. You can't, on the one hand, stand on the claims that you are defending international law and you are arguing for the rights of Palestinians under international law, and then you argue that Israel should disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether Israel is legitimate or not, which one could argue, my view is no state is legitimate. I get this question all the time. Is Israel legitimate? Well, look, we're stuck with it. My country is illegitimate.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, we've
the
stolen
nation state
it from
is
the
violent.
Aboriginals.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, that's the wrong question. And the Palestinians, to their credit, are not willing, like Hamas, are not willing to concede the legitimacy of Israel.
Right.
That's separate from recognizing and acknowledging its existence.
Mm-hmm.
That's not in question. And the Palestinians, to their credit, are not, they've long ago accepted that. But here's Winkelstein's point. If you're now arguing for one state, you are obliterating Israel. They have a right to the state, and you shouldn't use BDS as a disguise for that. And the other thing is that it plays into the hands of the Zionists and the pro-Israel lobby in the following way. They're terrible in this regard, but they use this idea that you want to have a one state. You're going to annihilate the state of Israel. And they use this inflammatory, you know, cataclysmic kind of rhetoric about, and as if we're going to push all the Jews into the sea, which is, and of course the Jews generally in the world, they respond to this. And, oh, BDS is terrible. It's like the Nazis. So you're playing into their hands with this sort of stuff.
So what's the structure of BDS? Like, I mean, I don't think, or I can't imagine that the one state solution, quote unquote, being the official BDS point. No, this just happens to be the.
It's not. No, yeah. No.
So this just happens to be the position of some of the key figureheads of the movement.
People.
Right.
And
right.
Increasingly people are talking one state. Right. I'm not persuaded about the one state thing. I was talking with these wonderful Palestinian guys yesterday and I asked them what they thought. There's a difference of opinion. I'm a bit pessimistic. And Chomsky has an important point about the one state thing, which is important. I mean, his view is. He's asked, do you believe in one state? He says, look, I believe in peace and love and, you know, truth and everything else. He said, nobody suggested the most simple, plausible step, the first step to take in that direction. Frankly, I think it's much less likely, however difficult the two states. But that's a conversation. Mind you, I also avoid these conversations to some extent.
Right.
Look, you get caught in these abstractions, these high-level issues about states, one state. They're killing people in the West Bank. They're demolishing their houses. We've got to stop that. Yeah. And it seems to me that's the more urgent thing. These things are important too, but, you know, we have to not lose sight of the realities of the suffering. This really appalling. I get very moved when I hear these poor Palestinians tell me their stories because it's very hard for us on the outside. We're not Palestinians. Because I talked about the violence and the rockets, and I felt a bit embarrassed yesterday because I was questioning as a tactic. It's fair enough to question it, but of course they told me that the suffering that they have, it's just unimaginable. One of them had his brother was killed. The other one had 9 members of his family killed. That's what we have to be looking at. Israel should stop these crimes.
Has the Israeli state itself made a statement against BDS? To what extent has the state...
Oh, are you kidding? You bet they have. Oh, okay. Not a statement. They have now laws making anybody in Israel that is supporting BDS now has to be subject to the prosecution so they compensate somebody who... They've now made a law that if anybody is a supporter of BDS, they're not allowed into the country. They've got a whole ministry devoted to BDS. They've got a minister whose sole... They regard BDS as, after Iran, the biggest strategic threat. You know what? That tells you how good it is. That tells you that it's working. If it's this peaceful movement of protest and non-violent act of conscience is a strategic threat to Israel, it tells you how illegitimate Israel's conduct is.
How about the response towards BDS from the Israeli left?
There is no Israeli left.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sad truth about Israel. Look, you know, I make the joke. I know all three of them. You know, I mean, you know, there's a few more. The fact of the matter is that, look, in Israel, whenever they have a war, they invade, you know, Lebanon in 2006. They had this atrocity in Gaza in 2014. All of the political parties supported. Now, there are a few heroic figures. As I say, I'm proud to know a few of them. Jeff Halper, Amira Haas, Gideon Levy, who writes in Haaretz. There's a bunch of heroic figures there. But look, you know, Gideon Levy had to have a bodyguard 24 hours a day when he was just writing articles about what's going on in Gaza. So he says, and this is why, repeating a point I made earlier, the Israelis are not going to solve this problem. It's not going to happen internally. The Palestinians aren't going to solve it. My view is they need us on the outside to put pressure on, and particularly on American government. That's the decisive factor.
Yeah. So what's been the factor behind the appeal of BDS then, because it's gained so much traction? Why do you think it's been effective compared to previous forms of communicating about the conflict?
Well, people are rightly desperate to do something. This is a cause that appeals to people's conscience around the world, as did South Africa and did East Timor. It's not the worst thing in the world. People, the Jews especially, say, why are you worrying about this? There's worse things. It's true. This is something we do something about. The main reason is that the governments of the world have simply abandoned the solution. America has thwarted a solution for years. The peace process has been a fraud. And there's a long story to tell about that. We haven't got time to go into the details of that. It's very shocking to read that because the general appearance is, if only they could have bilateral negotiations, that's the danger because that's taken away everything from the Palestinians. The loss of their state has been as a result directly of the fraudulent peace process and America's role in that. Okay, so what's left for us? And so this is a form of action that we can take to influence governments. It's frustrating because it's not quick enough and not direct enough, but there are examples as in South Africa, perhaps. It wasn't decisive in South Africa
either.
Yeah,
it wasn't, yeah.
And, but I think of the East Timor case where in Australia we were close to it. It was a decisive factor in keeping governments and the public conscious of the issue. And that helps to swing. And in the end, America told Indonesia to get out of East Timor and probably in South Africa. And we're hoping that, and it's shifting. In America, which is very important, the Jewish communities are starting to shift and the general public will shift. And that's perhaps the best hope.
Can you give us an update on what's happening in Australia? I mean, its relationship to the conflict as, you know, it's this official state position. Of course, how the local populace is reacting to it.
Well, we've done a survey and the general public are sympathetic. My group, APAN, did a survey. It's terrible that the Australian government is one of the few governments in the world that is up to its neck in the Israeli crimes and the occupation. Our prime minister and our foreign minister say, what occupation? There's no occupation. Excuse me? This United Nations resolution that was just passed, they said if they had been in the Security Council, they wouldn't have supported it. The Security Council resolution described Israel's behaviour, every settler, in flagrant violation of international law. Our government, we've just had Netanyahu visit and they were fawning over him, celebrating this, essentially a war criminal. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's where the Australian government is.
So we have to wrap up now, but before that, what practical advice can you give to our listeners who want to know more about this and who want to take action, right? What can they do? I mean, Malaysia, like you say, has a very active chapter, a very successful one as well.
You should get in touch with them for one thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is you have to read and become well-informed. Look, I get a question from people that talk to me, my Jewish friends and others. I give them this book to read and then the Zionists give them a different book to read. How can they make they read Alan Dershowitz and Finkelstein? How do they know? I haven't got an answer to that. You just have to read. So the first thing is to get well informed and look to sources that are contrary to your own understanding of prejudices to see what the other side is saying. Mm-hmm. And I can name the names, Ilan Pape, Chomsky, Finkelstein, about Gaza, Sarah Roy. These are the leaders, intellectual and academic and moral leaders in the world.
Yeah, and I remember it being a young leftist student too in college, and this was the before the days of Wikipedia and Google, and it was very hard to filter through all these different authors and the very rich literature, right, from both sides, quote unquote. But nowadays you have YouTube. It's so easy
but
to find speeches.
But there's everything on YouTube. That's the trouble with that. That you can find. My Jewish friends always show me the most horrible stuff, and that's what they think.
It's just the access to options are just much richer now. But also one a website that I would recommend is Electronic Intifada.
Absolutely, I'm glad you mentioned that. It's fabulous.
Fabulous.
And it's reliable.
Well written as well.
That's
accessible.
Ali Abu Nima. Absolutely right.
I think he's been in Malaysia before.
He was recently. I know with the same group that brought him out here. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, those are the options there, and I think just basic critical thinking and compassion, I think, can go a long way in kind of weeding through the different claims that are being made. You know, because I think at the end of the day, like you say, a lot of it goes into all these ideological turns and questions about history and abstraction, where I think basic human compassion can be exercised here, and I think it will take you to the right direction. Yeah. So, but thank you so much for sharing with us your knowledge and your experiences as well. Are you available on Twitter? Is there a way that people can reach you on social media?
And I use it mainly for Palestine. Okay. And my Twitter handle is at Slezak Peter, my name in reverse, capital S, capital P, Slezak Peter.
And you have a page on Facebook as well?
I have a Facebook. You can find me as well. Also, mainly used for Palestine.
Okay, well, thank you again for joining
the
show.
Thank you, Fuad. It's been nice talking with you.
You can email the show too if you want to send us questions or comments, and we can forward them to Peter. That's bfmnightschool@gmail.com, or look us up on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School on the search space and you'll find our page. Be sure to like that page if you haven't yet. Also, do download our app. You can find that at the iTunes App Store or Google Play. Once again, it was Peter Slezak, our guest today, talking about the Boycott, Divestment, Sanction movement. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.